David Gallanson is professor of economics at the University of Chicago. He's also the author of a book called Old Masters and Young Geniuses, The Two Life Cycles of Artistic Creativity. Gallanson told Steve Paulson about the roots of his theory of creativity, which goes back to Gallanson's days as a student at Harvard in the early 70s.
I took 17th century Dutch art from this wonderful guy named Seymour Slive, and the first day of class, the first thing he did was to put up a superb drawing of a Madonna and child. It was obviously a Raphael. And so after we'd looked at it for a minute or two, he said, Pablo Picasso did this copy of a Raphael drawing when he was 16 years old. What have you people done lately? And that was my introduction to this question of the life cycles of creativity.
So when did you actually start to develop your theory about creativity?
Well, I didn't develop the theory until I'd been doing this work for several years because I'm an empiricist and I'm very much experimental. But basically, almost about 10 years ago, I think it was the summer of 1997, I was doing a very complicated project. I'd been doing it for 5 years on 19th century immigration, and we were putting together enormous data sets, and it was getting kind of oppressive. And so for the summer, I decided that I would look at the age price profiles for about 24 modern American artists. And much to my surprise, I discovered that about half of them, the profile went up, up, up as they got older, and about half of them it went down, down, down. And that was the beginning of my thinking about this issue. The theory came much later. I mean, I generalize only very, very slowly.
Hmm. So what you discovered was that some artists, their work was most valuable when it was done when they were older. And for other artists, the most valuable work was done when they were quite young, maybe even in their 20s.
Absolutely. I mean, if you were to look at auction prices today, what you would find, in terms of the artists that I first studied in that paper in 1997, the abstract expressionists, people like Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning, Mark Rothko, Barnett Newman, Arshil Gorky, their late work is without exception more important, more expensive than their early work. Whereas then the next generation of artists I also studied, Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg, and then the pop artists, you know, Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, and then even the younger ones like Frank Stella, their very early work was almost always their most valuable work. In fact, this was one of the striking things that went back to my time in college.
So what do you make of this then, that some artists seem to peak when they're quite young and others keep developing as artists into old age?
Well, I mean, I've always believed that quantitative data are enormously valuable, primarily for posing questions rather than for answering them. And this was another case in point, because after I got that result, then I said, well, what's causing this? You know, why is it that the abstract expressionists were getting better with age, but then the next generation were, you know, essentially deteriorating? I started reading biographies, I read criticism, and sort of make a long story short, I discovered that there are these two very different kinds of artistic innovators, and they have these very different life cycles of creativity. One of the types is the people who improve with age. Their goal in painting, say, is to record their own perceptions, but they don't know how to do that. So they work very cautiously. I call them experimental because they proceed by trial and error. They work by trial and error. They just make little changes, and then they look at it. They say, is it better? Is it worse? And they continue. They develop their skills gradually over very long periods, and as a result, they typically produce their greatest innovations late in their lives.
Who would be examples of that kind of artist?
This is Pollock, de Kooning, Rothko.
Okay.
I mean, these are the people who, you know, if you read what they said about their work, they're constantly talking about their uncertainty. They're uncertain about their goals, not only for their careers, but for individual paintings. And in fact, see, these are people, the experimental people in general, and those artists very much in particular, are people who want to discover the work, discover the image in the process of making it. They want to be surprised. Those are people who, you know, try to begin their work with no preconception at all, and then they look at it, and they say, what do I see? What's developing? And I continue accordingly.
Hmm.
These people are very much seekers. By contrast, the other type of artist are as certain as the experimentalists are uncertain. And I call them conceptual because they privilege thought over perception. They know their goals because their goal is to express a particular idea or a particular emotion. And since they know exactly what they want to do, they tend to plan their works. Most of these people make preparatory drawings. Most of these painters, plan their works very carefully. They make their work systematically as a result. I mean, they know exactly what they want to do. So, you know, the execution is trivial. It's not important. I mean, for Jackson Pollock, the only thing that mattered happened in the process of painting. Whereas for Andy Warhol, he wasn't even there when his paintings were made. You know, he would take a photograph out of a magazine, he would give it to his assistant, tell him the colors he wanted, they would send it to a printing shop, they would get the silk screens back, and then the assistant would run the inks through them. If Warhol happened to be there, he would help, but he needn't be, because the picture was entirely preconceived.
Hmm. And you say that the great example of this conceptual innovator is Picasso, who really formulated the whole idea of cubism in his mid-20s.
Yeah, he's a very dramatic case because Picasso was stung at one point. I mean, this is this very, very arrogant, massively talented young artist, enormously ambitious, who comes to Paris and immediately sees that Henri Matisse is his competition for the leadership of the advanced art world. And he's stung because Matisse makes a great painting that gets an enormous amount of attention. And Picasso realizes he has to make a great painting. So at the age of 25, he starts making preparatory drawings. And all one winter, all one spring, he makes preparatory drawings for the largest painting that he has ever made to that point. In all, he makes something like 500 or 600 preparatory drawings and sketches for this painting. William Rubin said that was the largest amount of preparatory work that had ever been made for a painting in Western history. And it turned out to be the painting that announced the beginning of cubism, which was the most important development in 20th century art, not simply in painting, but in any of the arts. It had influence that went far beyond painting into sculpture, into movies, into architecture. And here's this 26-year-old guy who knew that this was going to be an enormously important painting because it was an idea that he had preconceived.
And this painting was?
The Demoiselle d'Avignon. It's in the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
And this was really the painting that launched the Cubist movement. I mean, that broke down the more representational style of painting.
It was. I mean, this was the first time in Western history, essentially, that an artist said, I'm going to create symbols of objects that are almost not recognizable as the objects. You know, this is not realism. This is not representational. This is not abstract in Picasso's hands, but it leads to abstraction.
So you're really suggesting that Picasso had an idea for what he wanted. I mean, even though he did all these hundreds of drafts of this painting, he was really working out the concept for how he saw art changing.
I think he was working out the precise composition. I think he had the concept. The concept was a very bizarre novel synthesis of earlier work, and I think that was the light bulb that went on in his head. Then what had to be done was to work out this very, very large, very complicated composition in order to make a large painting that would have an impact. And so I think, you know, the idea of cubism was in his mind. It was the implementation that took all of these preparatory drawings, and then, you know, then he was ready to make the painting.
You have a couple of great quotes that really set up this contrast of artistic styles. Picasso once said, "I don't seek, I find," which sort of sums it up. It's as if there's this thing out there in the world that it's a matter of him discovering. By contrast, Cézanne, who is more of a late bloomer, who kept refining and refining his style over the course of his life, he said, "I seek in painting."
Cézanne wrote wonderful letters, and many times he returned to this idea of seeking, and he described his career in art as almost a spiritual quest. In fact, he did several times use the analogy. He would write to Vallard, his dealer and friend Ambroise Vallard, about his frustration late in his life, and he would say, "Will I be like Moses, or will I be allowed to enter the promised land?" And at the very end of his life, he would write to younger artist friends, and he would write about his frustration that he could never, what he called, realize a complete work of art. And of course, the irony is that it's exactly at that time, it's exactly at the age of 66, 67, that he is making the paintings that will influence every important artist of the next generation, most notably Picasso. You know, it's not an accident that Picasso said, "I don't seek, I find," because it's in contrast to Cézanne's constant talking about seeking. Picasso knew that Cézanne was the great artist of the previous generation. Cubism comes largely out of the late Cézanne mixed together with a number of other arts, including African masks, pre-Roman Iberian painting, also Van Gogh's late work. But Picasso realized that Cézanne was really the source of his art. It's just that it took Cézanne about 40 years to develop his art fully, whereas Picasso could simply look at the late Cézanne and then immediately make the leap beyond it. So that Cubism is built directly on the late Cézanne. And, you know, we know since influence is what makes artists important, it's the importance of Cubism that makes Cézanne so important. The irony is Cézanne died not knowing about Cubism. I mean, he could literally have known about the Demoiselle d'Avignon. He died after it was made, but he was out of touch with Paris. But the irony is that if he'd known of it, he would have hated it because his art was a visual art, and he would have hated this conceptual symbolic art that Picasso made.
But why is it that the conceptual artist would make the big breakthrough early in life, you know, in his or her 20s or early 30s? I mean, why doesn't that happen with older people?
A colleague of mine was talking about economic theorists, and this is a very eminent theorist who's had a remarkable number of successful students. And he was sort of musing on it, and he said, yes, he said, you know, when they're students, they create these very unexpected but very simple syntheses of earlier work. And I think simplicity is the key here, because in order to violate the rules of a discipline, which the conceptual people do, you have to know the rules, but you can't have too much respect for them, and you can't have used them too long, because then they become part of your way of thinking. So the younger you are, if you're good at abstract thought, the simpler a place the world is, and the greater the clarity. As the conceptual people grow older, their habits of thought become more fixed, and the simplicity of the world starts to go away, because life, you know, the experience of living is complicated. You begin to say, gee, the world is a more and more complicated place, and their work tends to become more and more circumscribed, narrower, and therefore potentially less radically innovative.
Now, there are a lot of art critics who don't buy your theory at all, and especially they don't like to see an economist come in and apply statistical models and say, well, it's clear that this particular period in the artist's life is better than another period. How do you respond to that?
I don't really respond because they don't really make any intelligent comments. I mean, they don't buy it because they're bigots. The most disappointing thing to me in doing this work, I had thought that when I started this project, I would have exchanges with people like the professors who taught those courses. I've had virtually no exchanges with art historians. I've sent my work to 4 or 5 dozen art historians. I've never heard back from any of them. As you say, they don't buy it. They tell newspaper reporters that they don't like my work, but there has been no serious criticism of my work.
You know, I'm willing to bet that I am not alone in this, but I take great comfort in your theory, especially this notion of the late bloomers, and that, you know, you kind of keep refining your creative outlook on life, and hopefully, you know, the best is still to come.
There was a really wonderful magazine article about my work last year by a guy named Dan Pink, who is just a really excellent writer. He writes best-selling books, actually. And the way Dan put it was, you know, that there are hares in the world, but there are also tortoises, and that this work gives great comfort to those of us who have avoided peaking too early in life.
I like that.
David Gallinson is the author of Old Masters and Young Geniuses, The Two Life Cycles of Artistic Creativity. He spoke with Steve Paulson.